Guys, I'm really delighted to have back Mark Yusko of Morgan Creek Asset Management. It was very well received on a first chat that we had some time ago. And of course, is North Carolina based, so he's going to bring us the American take most certainly as well. Mark, where should we start? We've got the credit ceiling, or the debt ceiling, should I say. Is that credit card coming out? Is it going to be just political theater? Or could there be a risk that one of these days something gets a little bit disorderly out of one of these events?
You know, I think it's such a good question, Francis, and it is definitely political theater and has been for years. You know, the idea that there is a ceiling that then gets raised every single time. And the way they do it is they take prisoners, literally, and then exchange for things that one party wants in terms of pork barrel spending. So it's just a horrible system. You know, I prefer the Japanese system, which is, hey, we don't care about debt. We'll just, you know, buy it all ourselves. So ultimately, to your question about does it matter someday, in theory, it should, right? Like if you're a household, right? Your household, my household, and we have income, and if our spending exceeds our income, we get in trouble, right? Yeah. I mean, literally, we get in trouble. And in the old days, you went to debtor's prison. So for governments, it doesn't work that way because they can just turn on the printing press and print their way out. Now, what it does do over time, right, is it channels the wealth from the average person up to the tippy top through inflation, because you have to inflate your way out of the massive debt. And it's sneaky and it's surreptitious, but I actually think that's been the plan all along. So, you know, the average person, you go to Tokyo, they've been in this spiral of too much debt and everybody said they're going to collapse and the country's going to fail. And they went to 100% debt to GDP, 150% debt to GDP, 200% debt to GDP, no failure. Well, why? Well, because the average person's life really didn't change because they didn't own a lot of stocks and they didn't own a lot of real estate. They rented their apartment and they got paid their salary and they had a nice life and bought nice clothes and had a nice car. But if you look at the industry, right, they've had a whole two decades of just lost productivity, no real movement. But the people at the tippy top get super rich because their assets appreciate. And they're happy. So I think the same thing's going to happen in the U.S. or has been happening in the U.S. And the average person, as long as they can pay their bills and go out to eat once in a while and pay their rent, they won't revolt, although they probably should.
Yeah, it should have happened a long time ago. And I do fear, like you say, there's a lot of hand-wringing and fake sympathy for the Gini curve, but it seems to have been very well engineered and very well supported consistently over a multi-decade period. So I have to assume
it's unbelievable when you go back in time, actually 110 years now in the U.S. You know, from 1776 to 1913, a dollar was a dollar. Now I was finding it interesting. I always ask people, you know, where did the dollar come from? The word dollar, like I have no idea. Why is it called a dollar? Well, it's because we borrowed the idea from the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
And it's called the Reichsdollar. And we said, all right, that sounds like a good plan. And the Rothschilds had been in charge of banking for, you know, 600 years up to that point and started the first central bank in the Netherlands. So we said, all right, well, we'll copy that. Now, we didn't have a central bank. So from 1776 to 1913, a dollar was worth a dollar. Had a little fluctuation around two world wars. I mean, not world wars, but wars, civil wars. And long story short, in 1913, we created, again, based on the Rothschild model, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, which I always joke is neither federal nor has any reserves. It's literally a, you know, cabal of the banks, although I'm not supposed to use that word anymore. I found out that a certain, I didn't realize that the word cabal was offensive to people of the Jewish faith. I did not mean it to be. It just meant a small group of people in my mind, but I guess it so someone said I should use the word cartel. I'm like, well, that's just going to offend people in Latin America. So I don't know what to call it. So a small group of people controlled this central bank. It's owned by the other banks. And its job isn't to promote stability and low inflation. Its job is to slowly steal the wealth of the masses and widen that Gini coefficient. And if you look from time in 1913, when there was very low income and wealth disparity, to today, 110 years later, it's massive, the greatest of history. So,
What's a CEO multiple to average workers' wages in the US nowadays?
400-ish. Yeah.
Things were, you could still do well, but you didn't have to gouge everybody else out. It's a real pigs in the trough fest now, isn't it?
Yep.
I think the US is the most extreme in that particular regard as well.
By far. Yeah. And it's very disconcerting when you think about, look, I have great admiration and great respect and great willingness to give founders of businesses that create new ideas and new jobs, let them make all the money they want in terms of stock compensation and ownership. But when it comes to these ridiculous salaries.
To professional management. Yeah, especially if they weren't part of the beginning. They were just professional management. I think it was Guy Zerter who took over at Coca-Cola, and his compensation made him an instant billionaire on options and everything.
Right.
And that was professional management. You have to say, no, there was nothing godly about him. The brand that was so well established, it had such huge momentum, and globalization was in its peak throes. It was just hold the steering wheel, we're going to do 300 kilometers down the Autobahn. You don't need to do too much. Don't cock it up. And he picked up, unforgettable levels of wealth in terms of all of that. How about, let's pivot a little bit to the Middle East, if I can. The Saudis being far more vocal in divorce recently about taking other forms of payment, the slow unraveling of the petrodollar. I have a feeling that might be more damaging than debt ceiling chatter, talking about, we'll take yuan, we'll take other things. Russia and Turkey, et cetera, on a blockchain-related gold-back crypto, of all things, the emergence of these rivals. We spend a lot of time talking about it, but some big shoes are slowly starting to drop.
Oh, look, I think that is the big story of our day. I think you're exactly right, Francis, in that if we think about the petrodollar system, right, which really was a deal cut in 1971. Curiously, the same time that WEF was formed. It's really not coincidental, right? The whole Nixon era in the U.S. So not coincidental that WEF was formed, and we cut a deal with Saudi and said, look, here's the deal. We will protect you at all costs, irregardless of what you do, to whom you do it. Even if you do it to us, we'll still protect you as long as you price all oil-based transactions in the world in dollars. And ever since, that's what they did. And anyone who threatened that was disappeared, right?
Yeah.
So you think about Saddam Hussein said, no, I think I want to price oil in euros.
Yeah.
Vanished. Qaddafi said, I'm going to price oil in gold. Vanished. And
he was also talking a lot about Africa, which is a huge continent, and the gold-backed dinar that he wanted to bring in to establish sound money. Yeah.
And so
a lot of grime.
They threatened the dollar hegemony, and they were disappeared. So now, suddenly, we have this COVID event, which... obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but clearly now looks to me like was totally manufactured, and we called the flu something else and made, I think, the greatest policy error in history globally to lock down economies. But there was
only an error if you didn't intend to do it and it wasn't part of the plan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But I'll say there was intent. I'll go that far. And look, and it's interesting in that what it did is it created the beginnings of solidifying this two-axis world. And, you know, look, whether it was WEF, whether it was China, it doesn't really matter in the sense that China is the huge beneficiary here and Russia. And China and Russia basically came together on one side. The U.S. and the West came together on the other side. Now, a lot of it has to do with the fact that 20 years ago, I make this case that tech was evolving and you had to choose. And in the United States, we chose to be awesome in social media. Like, we're great at Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. Oh, actually, that's a Chinese thing, but we're awesome at
most of them, yeah.
Right? China decided to be really awesome at 5G and AI. I'm going to argue those are more important. And so we have this developing schism, two-party world, and the lockdowns happen, and we use the dollar as a weapon, which we always have, and we impose sanctions on Iran, and we impose sanctions on Russia. And what happens? China says, you know what, Russia, we'll buy your oil. Just send it here. But you have to price it in renminbi. And so things start to go downhill and oil prices start to surge. And the administration here in the U.S. says, hey, Saudi, our friend, here's what I need. I need you to pump more oil to get the price of oil down so I can get reelected. And oil, and Saudi, for the first time, says, pound sand. Like, whoa, we cut a deal in 71, and you're supposed to do this. And I'm like, we got new friends. So now Saudi is talking to Russia, China, about selling oil to them, pricing it not in dollars. And so I think this is a monster story.
I think it's a monster story. Combine it with the cut and run of Afghanistan, which I think was a real pivot on military competence and flippance, you know, the tendency to flip and cut and run. I think those two things have led to the emboldenment and also the Russia-Ukraine, which we've kind of provoked but not gone into fight with. So you're already committed in a kind of proxy war. The policies and the decisions seem designed to have made American fiscally in terms of the dollar and militarily look
I don't understand. I mean, I really don't understand how you got Russia to, when I say how you got, meaning us, got Russia to attack, in the sense that, you know, Ukraine has been this, how should I say it, place where U.S. interests have tried to thwart the Russian dominance of the region. And every time something bad was happening in Ukraine, you could trace it back to a pipeline deal, right? There are these pipeline deals going all over from Turkey and Greece. And every time we got involved in the region, and, you know, when the president's son was sitting on the board of some Ukraine company, it's like, what the heck is that? There was a reason. And now we send massive amounts of money to Ukraine. I mean, last count, $116 billion. I mean, there are millions of kids that go to bed hungry every night in the United States, and we're sending money to Ukraine? I don't understand. So there's something about this, you know, again, it's all about oil and oil and gas. So ultimately, there's this conflict, and I'm not trying to minimize the conflict. There certainly is a conflict, but it hasn't escalated into World War III. It really has kind of been this de-escalating event. And to your point, almost like military theater instead of political theater, almost like military theater. And you know, we got this Zelensky figure who is an actor, right? I mean, literally, like an actor. So we have comedians, right, who've been presidents of countries in Europe, and actors, and of course we had an actor in the United States too, Ronald Reagan. And we'll probably have one with The Rock, right, at some point. But it's an interesting dynamic. But geopolitically, the petrodollar system is got cracks in it. The yuan-based system is surging. And here's my thought on that, Francis, in the sense that if you think about world reserve currencies, right, since the 1400s, they've lasted about 80-ish years. First was Portuguese, which you think, how did Portugal have the world reserve currency? Well, they had the fastest ships. And back then, it was all about the Navy. And then Spain took them over. They got their trees. So they had the fastest ships. Then the Netherlands took them. Then France took them over. Then the Netherlands took them over. And then half of the Rothschilds moved to Britain, invented the steamship, and suddenly they had the most powerful navy. And so the UK had about a 90-year run. And then we invented nuclear, and now we have the most powerful navy. But here's my contention. I believe the next world reserve currency won't be backed by naval superiority. It'll be backed by cyber superiority. The next war, I believe, will be fought with chips, not ships. And so that's why China is so focused on AI, 5G, chip manufacturing, advanced materials. You know, they have 96% of all the citations in AI in research.
Yeah. Can I comment on that and interrupt your flow a little bit? Because that's fascinating. I've just finished reading Reichardt's book, Sold Out. And he talks of the Five Eyes intelligence agencies. I don't know if that's a misnomer, but anyway, we'll part on comment on that.
Oxymoron.
He didn't include Israel in that, which I thought was an omission, because I think they're the second biggest after America, and they probably control half of the American three-letter agencies anyway. But the subject line was, there's nine key technical areas. So the supply chain is too much the factory of the world is China. They were talking about vitamin C and penicillin in Australia and New Zealand, all these various percentages that are over-dominated by the single workshop of supply. And then he said, in these nine areas, which are areas of the future, we cannot be relying too much on this country as a component because of, you know, the claims of IP theft, even though in many instances China has actually advanced the technology, which I think is part of the statement you were making. I'm going to try to see if I can recall them all because I try to commit them to memory. These are also going to be investment themes as well. So it won't surprise that the easy ones come up first. AI, which you've already mentioned, number one. Number two was robotics. And then a rather more mundane sounding one was computer hardware, which sounds very much like old tech, but is still important and includes a lot of other things. So AI and robotics and computer hardware. Number four was cryptography. So the crypto is going to play some form of a role, but I think that's going to be a government blockchain role. How that affects Bitcoin and our existing ecosystems there, we can discuss in a minute. Five was materials and manufacturing sciences. So that immediately had me thinking. My father was involved in the original preeminence of carbon fiber. He did designs for surgery when people still used to have steel put in their bodies. I don't know if you were old enough to recall that, but new hip joints, people were back running and horse riding. So it was a great success. And more recently, I remember a decade and a half ago, because I'm on all these financial newsletters, graphene was being pushed as this new miracle thing. And then it went real quiet. And then we have the medical story, and we find out a lot of people actually pointing out that this particular material is showing up in that advice. But that's material and manufacturing sciences. That's number five. Number six was quantum technology. So quantum is very, very voodoo. And hard for me to conceptualize and understand, but it is unbelievable. It's quantum and physics, and there's so much more that needs to be explained there. I'm not even going to try explain it for myself. Then eight and nine, nanotechnology was the next. So these are, just as a reminder, industries that the intelligence services of the West have said we have too much reliance. They cannot be allowed to get IP transfer out of these key industries. Nanotechnology was in there. And this one scares me. Synthetic biology. So this is literally your ear grown on the back of a pig, or your robotic transhumanistic arm. So these transhumanism types of agendas seem to me very interesting, and the whole tweaking of cells and various other things. So those nine industries came up, and it was just really interesting to see you make reference to AI and China's lead role in that. And now that there's this allegedly at an intelligence level, the point to block on that. So yeah, I don't know if you'd heard that.
I think it's so profound that you go through that list, in that everything that we talk about that edges up to military conflict relates to one of those things. I'll give you a couple examples. So I could never understand why Venezuela was such a big story for the last few years. Like, okay, it's a perfectly nice place to visit. It's a beautiful country. But it's really not a global superpower, and probably not something that should be, you know, discussed every single day. But it turns out that there's a rare earth mineral called tantalum that is only found two places in the whole world. And one of them happens to be Venezuela. And you must have it in order to create these little babies, these little supercomputers that we all carry around in our pocket. And so we had to install, shall we say, a dictator who would then
export some democracy.
Yeah, install some democracy, right. Yeah, some democracy. And so it's stories like that where you think about whether it's cobalt, right? Which there are only a couple places in the world you can get cobalt, which you need for EVs. And
on that point, if I could jump in, cobalt, I don't know if you saw that Joe Rogan mini snippet that was going around from the cobalt expert, and he virtually was saying, he didn't use this phrase, but virtually all cobalt mining is blood cobalt, you know, as in the way that you would say blood diamonds. So it's literally kids in flip-flops in Africa scratching in the dirt with hand shovels and various other things. And he showed a lot of imagery. It was quite contentious. So there is no ethical cobalt collection, and a lot of it's from Africa.
And the same thing is true of so many things. But at the end of the day, tech is here. I mean, you and I are talking from halfway around the world to each other live in HD. And I always say I wish it weren't HD, because I look better if it's kind of fuzzy. But the interesting thing is that's not going back in the box, right? We're not going to have less technology. We're not going to have, you know, less. Like when I was growing up in the United States, there was a show on TV, The $6 Million Man, about this guy, right? An accident, and they made him bigger, better, faster, stronger, with new legs and an arm and a super eye. And now that's not that far away. And, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it seemed impossible. And the fact that they thought you could do it for 6 million, probably billions now. But it is interesting in that all of this does go toward military and global superpower superiority, because it's about tech. And, you know, when I think about China in particular and the U.S., you know, the U.S. has this arrogance, right? I live here and I listen to it, and it's like, you know, we're the only country that matters, and we're all the smart people, and we have the center of the universe in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is amazing. And much of the best technology innovation comes from there, but not all. And then what happens is 20 years ago, yes, China sent their smartest kids here. And yes, they borrowed, shall we say, stole technology. And you would find routers reverse engineered, even down to the bugs from Cisco. Okay, fine, that happened. Today, they're not copying us. In fact, it's the opposite. China, here's a crazy stat. China, every year, graduates 4.5 million STEM engineers.
Yeah.
United States graduates about 500,000.
Yeah.
And everybody says, oh, but they're not all good. I'm like, fine, let's say half of them are bad. Probably not true, but let's say half are bad. That's still five times more than the United States. And not all of ours are good. So not everybody goes to MIT and Caltech, right? So I find it interesting how this Western rhetoric of, you know, dominant superpower, that's fine. But if you've ever seen the 30-year plan, amazing. China has these 30-year plans. They don't say it. In America, we can't even think 30 months. Forget 30 years, right? We're good if we think about 30 days in some cases. But they have a 30-year plan. And so the first one from 1990 to 2020 was to move from a socialist economy to a moderately prosperous socialism economy. It was called the Harmonious Rise. Not threatening. Like I say, outsource everything to China. We're your friend. We'll make stuff for you. Great. From 2020 to 2050, the plan is to become a prosperous socialism economy, aka superpower. That's not quite as friendly, shall we say, for the U.S. And I find the whole thing quite astonishing that they're thinking in 30 years and long term and playing the long game, and we're quibbling amongst ourselves, and they're cutting deals with Russia and they're cutting deals with Saudi, and we're just wringing our hands saying, well, hey, wait, we're the superpower. Like, yeah, we are, but so was the UK. The UK was, past tense, the superpower, right? America was an emerging market run by a gang, and that's no longer the case. So things do change.
It's funny, when I look at this list that I just gave you and I wrote down, you mentioned a movie, and I feel the Terminator series is my choice of movie, because when you talk about AI, robotics, you talk about computer hardware. There was also networks and telecommunications as part of that. Crypto. We had Bill Gates. Apparently, this went round. He had registered an interesting number of patents. It was all the sixes that had a workout chip in the body and a blockchain wallet that was credited for push-ups performed or exercise performed under command. So like a sort of a payment mechanism for exterior or physical work done. And then you go quantum nanotech. You think of all of those things. I don't know if you recall the second Terminator, where they had the guy that melted and could go through the floor like a lump. Yeah. They could reassemble. Yeah. And he was like liquid mercury. And I have a feeling that every single one of these are globules of mercury that are all coagulating and coming all together, and it is this Terminator 2 weapon, and it is military, as you mentioned. It's totally military, but it's military. It feels like government against citizen across. Yes, we have the supposed U.S. versus America, but you have the likes of Gates and everybody praising, and World Economic Forum praising essentially a communistic, totalitarian dictatorship, for which again, Z sounds like he's actually made himself president for life now, where before they'd committed to rotating terms. So you've actually got an escalating totalitarianism going on there. This assumption of Hong Kong and the suppression of dissent, a bit of foot stamping about Taiwan. And it seems like all the components, that flowing mercury into this monster before us, and we're sitting there and it's this almost superhuman thing that's going to be turned on.
Wait, think about social credit scoring. Think about access. You know, this whole zero COVID fiasco was very dystopian. right?
And the carbon footprint, because that got mentioned again in Davos recently with all the payment systems, you know, how, where you bought, how you bought, what's your contribution to carbon.
But see, that's also a false flag. Carbon has nothing to do with anything, right?
Mm.
One volcanic eruption releases more carbon into the atmosphere than all of human existence. Let that sink in for a second. One volcano. So in and about carbon. Carbon, is, and it's not about global warming. Actually, you don't hear about global warming as much the last few years. Why? Because we're actually cooling, right? We're back to, when I was growing up, again, 1970s, the cover story was not global warming, it was global cooling, the next ice age, the ice age.
Yeah. And I remember.
We have an 11-year cycle. Every 11 years, you get a period of warming and then cooling. Why? Because of sunspot activity. People say, Mark, you're crazy. I'm like, no, I'm not. We have the greatest nuclear reactor that we've ever known, right? It's the only one we know because there are other stars around, but it's a giant nuclear reactor. And it generates heat. I mean, think about, there's an amount of energy that hits the Earth every day could power all of the Earth forever, right? Now, we don't harness that energy, but that energy goes into create plant life and ocean life and human life. But that is the way it works. And when there's more, you know, fission in the sun, we get warming. And here's the interesting thing. We get less viruses.
Definitely.
Really interesting, right? And when there's less activity, we get cooling and there's more viruses because viruses come from the atmosphere, right? They come down from the atmosphere and they get burned up by the radiation unless they don't. And if they don't, and here's the funny thing. There was a paper. I love this. There was a paper written in 2017, okay, 2 years before COVID, that said, in 2019, fourth quarter 2019, actually had it down to almost the day. Fourth quarter 2019, there would be a new pandemic based on solar activity. And it would happen. This is the great part. They said it would happen in the mountainous regions of China and then spread to the rest of the world. In 2017. That's some guess, right? And it's just math. And then what was interesting is, if you look at, again, sunspot activity in the beginning of 2020 and 2021, it went right back up.
Yeah.
And unshockingly, the virus started to go down. And then it mutated to try to stay alive. And when you mutate, it gets weaker. And now it's the common cold. And lots of people are going to catch it, but have very little symptoms because it went from being the flu to the cold. Like, here's the crazy thing. You and I, we probably got a cold this winter. I got a cold this winter. It's possible that we have a mutation, a fragment from the 1917 Spanish flu.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable to me, right? That this virus could mutate over and over and over every year. And for 100 plus years, it can survive, but it becomes weaker and weaker and weaker as it mutates. So I find all of this very, like you said, like this coalescing is, if the powers that be, okay, which are all interconnected, right? People forget that, you know, Bill Gates' mom was friendly with a whole bunch of people in the WEF, and then they magically got the contract from IBM to become the operating system when there was a far superior system called CPM down in California that should have got the contract. Although I heard that was a self-inflicted wound. So IBM flew to Seattle, met with Microsoft, and they're like, no, you guys are a bunch of young hippies. No, went to California. But the guy, it was a husband-wife team, and the guy was like, got to sign my NDA. And IBM's like, dude, we're IBM. We don't sign NDAs, right? You either want to be with us or you don't. And he wouldn't relent, and they left, went back and signed the deal with Microsoft. So, but they never would have even got, Microsoft never would have even got the chance if it weren't for Bill's mom. So I want to go back to cryptography for a second. So leaving the world of WEF and all that craziness, which is all tied back to your military intelligence thing, which is really interesting, and particularly Mossad. But if you think about cryptography, why is cryptography so important? Cryptography is really important because it allows the creation of unique assets in the digital world. And that's a really, really, really important thing. So what Satoshi Nakamoto gave us, whoever he, she, they are, yes, Bitcoin's wonderful and amazing and very important, but it's more than that. It's the ability to create a unique asset in the digital ecosystem. And what does that mean? Well, again, record albums. Grew up playing record albums, physical, analog devices, black vinyl disc, you put it on a turntable, spun around, made music. Well, then they're like, well, but I could record that electronically and call it an MP3 file. And then I could copy paste, send you a copy, and you could listen to a song. I could listen to a song and we were both happy. But the music industry was very unhappy because they wanted you to buy your own song and me to buy my own song. So what did they do? They shut down Napster and they shut down any way of copying music. And now what do? We all stream digitally, uniquely identified through cryptography, and we all have to pay, which is the way it should be. And more importantly, because we know when a streaming service plays a song, the artist actually gets paid instead of, you know, it going off into the ether. So the ability to have digital assets and beyond music, stocks, bonds, currencies, commodities, art, real estate, private businesses. Once everything is on a blockchain, and the blockchain is just simply an open public ledger, but once it's cryptographically secure in a line item, which is what a token is. A token is not a thing. It's not a little piece of gold. A token is a line item in a ledger that is cryptographically secure and says who owns what. So I own a Bitcoin, you own a Bitcoin, I own a piece of property, you own a piece of property. All of that is nicely laid out in this public ledger, and we have truth. And what's cool about truth is it replaces the need for trust. In the old days, the last 800 years, we had to rely on trust. Trusted third parties, banks, insurance companies, brokerage firms. And like I right now have to trust that my money that sits at Bank of America is actually there and they didn't take it, right? Because it's my word against theirs. I actually have a nightmare, Francis, that I go to the ATM and I punch in my code and it says zero. Like, how would I prove it's not zero? I don't have a statement. I haven't had a statement for years, and it's literally their word against mine. And so I have to trust them. Well, if I have a Bitcoin on a hard drive or on a cold storage device, I don't have to trust anybody. I have truth. I have an entry on a ledger that says Mark owns that Bitcoin. That is frightening for the powers that be, because they like being the trusted third parties, right? Bank of America likes the fact that they can tell me, oh, I'm sorry, you can only transfer $25,000 out of your bank account.
What do you mean? That's guardianship. That one in the hole.
And it's like, no, I'm sorry. That's the daily limit. That's all you can take. Like, that's unbelievable to me. It's supposedly my money, but it's not. It's the bank's money. I have an IOU, and I trust that they'll make good on that IOU. But in this new world of cryptographically secure assets on blockchains, don't need that. And that is extremely frightening. And here's the one thing. You know, Jamie Dimon was in Davos, and you know, he got up and he was, you know, pissing all over Bitcoin and saying it was a Ponzi, and all, everybody got mad. Like, guys, don't get mad. Celebrate. Like, celebrate what? The guy's a jerk. I'm like, yeah, but here's the thing. He's one of the most powerful people in the world. You may not like him, but just factually, he, in charge of JP Morgan, is one of the most powerful people in the world. Full stop. Okay. He gets his 10 minutes of fame at Davos on CNBC. He could talk about anything he wanted to. He could talk about the weather. He could have talked about crickets. He could have talked about anything he wanted. What is he talking about? Bitcoin. He says, no, well, that was because Joe Kernan made him. Like, look, when you get interviewed, you don't have to answer the question. You deflect and redirect, right? You could ask me a question and I could decide I want to answer that question. Or I could say, yeah, Francis, I'm going to deflect. I'm going to talk about what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So Jamie could have deflected, but instead he talked about Bitcoin. Now, why did he talk so negatively about Bitcoin? Well, because it threatens his hegemony. It threatens the bank's hegemony. And here's the thing. I have this thing that I believe. You can judge the quality of an idea by the quality of its detractors. If you have an idea and no one cares, it's really not an important idea. If you have an idea and the average person disagrees with you, not really that important.
I did see that clip you're referring to. I did see that clip. He praised blockchain, however, the system.
Of course.
He just isn't thinking much of the token. So he's seeing it as a payment system as
of
great
course.
Significance in the great future.
He's back to what you said, Francis. He understands that Swift and ACH and Fedwire are 70-year-old technology. They're slow. They're expensive. They're insecure. And blockchain, using cryptographic security, is far superior. But right now, Bitcoin used blockchain to create a banking system, can't call it a bank, but a banking system, a financial system, that doesn't need him.
Mm.
Well, he's like, whoa, no, that Bitcoin, that's bad, that's bad. But this blockchain's good. And he's trying to create something called JP Morgan Coin. In fact,
but don't you think, given that we're run by the banking cartel, that's exactly the outcome they want? They're going to take on that which is good, which they can expropriate, because there's no Satoshi. They don't even have to pay a license fee. They don't have to do anything to anybody. They can build a chain. No one's going to charge them for the IP. It's a free railway system, and put their own trains on it on the basis that we don't need your token. We need the infrastructure.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. That's what's coming, and that's what CBDCs are. And that's why
look,
China's already there, right? China has a CBDC. They are using it for surveillance. They're using it for control. And look, it's a dystopian future if
it is.
Governments convert fiat into central bank digital currencies, because they're not cryptocurrencies. A cryptocurrency is a decentralized currency that isn't controlled by any centralized authority and can't be devalued and can't be controlled. But if you've,
wasn't created by them.
They want it created by them, and they want to control it. And I don't know if you've seen Augustin, whatever his last name is, the guy from BIS. You know, I mean, the guy, he looked, I used to say he looked like Jabba the Hutt, but no, he looks like Kingpin from the Spider-Man movie. He looks like Kingpin. He's a giant guy.
I've seen him.
And he says, well, of course, we should control your money. Of course, we should be able to say, you know, if you don't spend your money by Friday, it goes out, it disappears. Or, how about this? You get paid on Friday, have a couple cocktails, you drunk text about the president, and you wake up the next morning, and your money's worth 80 cents on the dollar. They could do that. Or, let's say Walmart pays the government extra to say, you know what? The money doesn't work at Target. We want it to work only at Walmart. That could happen. And people are like, no, it'll never happen. Yeah, it'll happen. And so we need to opt out. And so, look, we're all going to live where we live for now. And in so doing, you have to subject yourself to the rules of law in those areas. And the fiat in that area. But I don't have to have all my money in fiat. I can take some portion of my wealth out of that fiat system, out of what will eventually be that central bank digital currency system. I can put it in this other system, Bitcoin, and it preserves that wealth away from the decimation. And people say, well, but they'll just make it illegal. Like, well, right. But they've tried that, right? They tried that with gold in 1933, and it didn't work. We still have gold. And they'll do all kinds of stuff. Like, they cut off Binance from Swift the other day. Okay, that makes it harder to transfer your Bitcoin or digital assets back into fiat, but not impossible.
Can I come in on that point as well? By Binance cutoff, actually, and the Russian appropriation of their funds actually hastens the collapse of your particular payment system. Because
Correct.
People think you're making too many moral judgments about who's good and who's bad and who should be allowed to use the system. Instead of being agnostic and utilized by all and accepted by all and never under question, you now think, well, we've got to be careful about using this system because recently we said X, Y, Z and they might not like us. And when our money's stopping over in one of their banks, it might suddenly get frozen, etc. So yes. In essence, those activities that appear short-termist to gain are actually long-termist, the death of that particular rail. And the SWIFT system, the ACH, and the dollar freezing of assets actually is short-sighted, I would argue. Is that correct?
Totally agree. And again, that's incredibly powerful analysis and insight, which is exactly right. But that's the nature of short-term thinking that plagues elected government officials, right? If you know your time is limited, right? You have to get elected and your time is limited, then you're going to make decisions that make you look good in the short run and that, you know, buy you votes in the short run. And right now, we collectively, the United States, have decided that China is the enemy. We always have to have an enemy, right? We had the USSR when it was the USSR and, you know, Russians and communists, and that was the enemy. And then that kind of went away. And then we had a period where we didn't really have an enemy. So we created a bunch of little enemies, and there was the Nicaragua scandal, and there was, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq. And so we always have to have an enemy. Now we've basically made China the enemy. And the reason we made China the enemy is because they actually threaten our hegemony. And I get it, but it's kind of like, I describe it as China's play and go, which is this amazing strategy game, which is not about direct confrontation, right? And I'm not a Go expert, but Go is about regional, so to speak, regions of the board dominance. And so you're playing multiple games at the same time versus the US and Europe and the Western powers are arguing about how to set up the checkerboard. Like, you guys aren't setting up the checkerboard right. Like, guys, we're not playing checkers. You're playing checkers. And you know, they say Putin's a 3D chess grandmaster. Yeah, probably. But China's playing Go. And it's just a very different game, and they keep winning, right? They win in terms of intellectual content, right? They win in terms of engineering advancement. They win in terms of cryptographic security. They win in terms of, you know, creating this massive axis along the Silk Road from China all the way through India, Africa, Greece, up into Russia. Whoa, 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 whoa. And what people forget, right? I love this part. For 2,000 years, right? We've had 2,000 years-ish of modern history. China was number one for 1,800 of those 2,000 years. And only the last 200 did they lose it because of a failed experiment with communism and Mao. And America, when Europe had it for a while, then America took over. So for the last 200 years, you've had Western dominance, but that Western dominance is now fading. And the axis, the center of the universe, is shifting back toward East. That Silk Road initiative.
I want to talk to you about the money. Where's the money flowing? Because the money, to me, Kissinger is always worth listening to his opinion, because it seems like from his lips, it will be. But he says, follow the gold, if gold is going east, or follow the money, it's going east. And this is, of course, to the more China is the communistic east. But if the Five Eyes are going to really restrict supply chain, we've seen technical structure that we really like on the Singapore Straits Index that we think could move an immense amount. And that seems to be the acceptable face of listing if you were to have Chinese interests but want to retain global concern in and around, because Hong Kong clearly isn't anymore. And then also we have a feeling that the Middle East is going to come a long, long way. So from Tel Aviv, to Saudi, Qatar, all of these nations, there's going to be a lot more capital formation. Got a couple of people, as I said, that were telling me that Brinks were doing bulk of their gold moving was actually from Switzerland to Dubai, Qatar, and various other places. So there's a there seems to be where's the flow going to go? And before you answer, I want to show you an interesting thing. I've actually put this in front of one or two people. It's not a metrics that has to mean anything per se, but it's a demonstration of total market cap of the economies by nation divided by its population. Now, population is just raw potential. And in some populations, people don't self-actualize very highly, and in others they do. But generally, when you get organized, there will be a tendency to the mean. I'm going to share screen with you a little bit and show you this spreadsheet so that you can join on along with me. But if I go and get the spreadsheet up, there we go. This is the market capitalization in billions of the markets by country. So the US is a 40 trillion market cap. So if I just grab the fat cokey there. So this is USA 40 trillion. And if I divide it by the population number, it's around 336 million, you have $119,000 of market cap per individual to hold up.
Yep.
So that's the exercise as a matrix. I'm now going to list the BRICS, as we know. This doesn't include Saudi, but it includes China, which has 11 trillion, which works out at $7,700, so 7,700 versus 120, essentially. Yep. India adds a surprisingly low 2.7. I think this is a potential growth point when they get their act together, English language and all. 2.7 trillion and 1,900. So under $2,000 of market cap to be held up in India. Russia, just under half a trillion, so 447 billion. And that is $3,000 a citizen. They're on 125 million people.
Yep.
Brazil, that's on around 220, is on half a billion. That's about 2,380,000 a person. I tend to think very simplistically, Brazil, agri, Russia, commodities, steel and energy, China, tech, and a lot of other manufacturing. South Africa, I've got in there, they're the smallest arm of the BRICS, but they're at about 0.8 of a billion. And quite a high number, $12,700 a head per person of the BRICS. That's one of the highest. But it's quite a long-standing stock market, a big gold producer in the original days, diamonds. Oppenheimer's the strand of the Rothschild family you mentioned. Yeah. So financialization, a lot of dual listings in London. So it's got a first world, third world connection that's seen quite high-rated companies and then a big, no mid-tier and a big gap to the bottom. Japan has just another very well-developed nation with worse demographics than the boomers that hit peak retirement in quarter four last year in America. The Japanese are already through that. They're the more elderly diapers than baby diapers. 4.9, so 5 trillion on and giving you about $40,000 of market cap to hold up. And demographic peak in well into its demographic peak. So I thought that's quite interesting numbers. And if we just totaled the entire BRICS and got an average, so if we're doing a BRICS versus USA market cap thing as an exercise, you'd have 15.5 trillion in all BRICS market cap, and you would have $4,700 held up by every citizen in those nations. So as an aggregate. That's about 3.2 billion of the globe's population, by the way. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. So the US is the blue pie here in the pie chart.
Yep.
And then China's the orange. And the brown is the summation of all the BRICS, because I've also included it. So that's really not part of the pie, because that's a double count. But even the summation is still substantially smaller than the US. And then you have each of the components. The gray was India, I think it was, India, Russia, Brazil, South Africa had a fairly meaty slice there, and then Japan. So we've thrown Japan in there as a bit of a mix. But I don't know what your comment is on the future, because my overall feeling is technology and technology hubs can move. Smart people can
move. They do. And if you did that same analysis, I love the analysis because it's exactly right in that human potential is human potential is human potential. And financialization is something that the United States has done really, really well in the last 40 years. And we went from a normal level of financialization per person to this extreme. And it's actually not dissimilar. If you did the same analysis 100 years ago, the turn of the century, when the British Empire was number one, you would have found the same type of dispersion, but it would have been weighted to the UK. And the US was a little tiny sliver like China. It was the emerging market, didn't have a lot of a population, didn't have a lot of industry. And the bet, right, is the great, you know, the famous Gretzky quote, but it was actually Gretzky's dad who said, you know, what makes Wayne great is he doesn't skate to where the puck is. He skates to where the puck is going. Yeah. And the same thing to your point, you know, Singapore and Dubai as being new money centers. What's interesting about money, right? There's only one money in the world. Only one. And I could argue now there's about to be a second, but gold is money. It's the only money. And money is an asset that exists in the absence of a liability. Everything else is credit. And credit and currencies exist in every country, right? And, you know, in America, we have green pieces of paper. And in China, they have red pieces of paper. In Israel, they have yellow pieces of paper, but they're just pieces of paper. And ultimately, they're all backed in some way, shape, or form by gold at central banks or other currencies held by central banks, et cetera. But ultimately, Bitcoin, I believe, becomes digital gold, becomes a digital version of gold and sound money going forward. So the next 5,000 years, my guess is we migrate from physical gold to digital gold. But there's still only one money, which is this asset that exists in the absence of a liability. So central banks will hold these money assets, gold ultimately and Bitcoin, and then they'll build the credit system on top of that. And to your point, if you just think about mean reversion, the credit creation and the financialization in the BRICS as they mature. I mean, here's the thing. Take China, right? China took 700 million people, right? Which is basically the US plus Europe, out of abject poverty out of the last 30 years. So they went from total poverty to lower to traditional middle class. Not upper class, not wealthy, just middle class. Those 700 million people are going to move up the value chain. And, you know, one of the things that I heard a long time ago, and I loved it, and it explained the big commodity boom 20 years ago, was when you reach middle class, right? When you come out of poverty, the first thing you buy is an air conditioner. Right? Because you want your life to be comfortable. So the first thing you buy is air conditioner. Then you buy an air conditioner for your parents. Then you buy an air conditioner for your uncle. And so air conditioners, interestingly, take 11 pounds of metals out of supply. Copper, aluminum, et cetera. So every, you know, commodity went on a bull market as those 700 million people came out of poverty and bought their air conditioner. Well, once you get an air conditioner, then you want to buy a scooter, and then you want to upgrade to a car, and then you want to have an apartment, and then you want to have a computer, and then you want to have a television. And ultimately, all of these things occur. And so this idea that an aging West, where every single day in the United States, 10,000 people turn 65, right? And I'm getting closer and closer to that every year, but interesting thing, 65 to 85-year-old people, they're not very productive. They're perfectly nice people, but they're not very productive the way we think about productivity. And they don't...
They divest out of the stock market a whole bunch and out
of... Divest. Yeah. Well, they divest at age 71 and a half because that's the law. And again, 10,000 people every day turn 71 and a half and they have to start divesting. And that divesting is going to be about $1 trillion a year for the next 20 years. A trillion. And that'll go from stocks to bonds. Because again, when you're in your 70s, you hope you have a good long life still, you know, could live another 30 years, but you favor liquidity over growth. And so that's probably going to continue to put pressure on interest rates globally in the West. And it's going to continue to make the governments able to overspend and issue massive amounts of bonds. So ultimately, your analysis of market cap per person is really, really important in that over time, individuals move up the value chain. And yeah. as they move up the value chain, they have very repeatable patterns of consumption. So if you look at certain countries, you know, China, it's like being in the United States in the 1970s, and they're going to reach the same level of financialization and consumption. They were manufacturing, they are a manufacturing economy. They'll eventually be a consumer economy. And Vietnam and Cambodia and all these other places will become the manufacturing. Yeah.
Those are the ones I'd almost wait rather, because interestingly enough, China had a negative population growth last year. I don't know how much it had to do with experimental medicine, but they are certainly being grounded. But you've got Indonesia, for example, demographically, which have a great youth curve. That whole Southern Asian, though, you know, the strips and the bits. And they, when you have a big, if you're a great successful businessman, in Indonesia, you're probably going to either list in Jakarta or you're going to properly go to Singapore. Singapore is, yeah. you know, it's only in America that the listing has to be in America. You know, European companies yeah. are listed in London or in Frankfurt. And in the same way, those other smaller, but that conglomeration of nations, we'll see the localized Switzerland head for banking and finance as being Singapore. And I think as energies and the new tech moves, I have a feeling that tech is going to shift a little bit. Some of the best minds are going to go to Tel Aviv, back where I think it's all the, some of the best secrets have already been appropriated. And you're going to see the tech now actually coming directly out of Saudi, Tel Aviv, maybe even Turkey to some degree, and Qatar. And we're going to start seeing something more innovation rather than petrochemicals. And we probably see some mine. They've got micro cap markets. Caps at the moment, but I do just feel if we are buying a tracker, an index fund of the globe, right now America looks real expensive, has commanded a premium for a long time that I no longer feel it earns. And I think if you want to be ahead of the money wave, where do you position? Because it's by being early, not too early. You can have a bumpy old ride, but if you're doing a tracker for the next 30 years so that you have a great retirement, or even into your retirement, you have something that's still shown growth, even though you might want income, you're going to have doing so much growth, you can even divest and still be growing your capital and moderately. Where do you want to be? Where's the multiples coming? And I think divesting away from the demographic turn and seeing a bit more of the tech no longer just being a pure San Francisco play. Yep. And other nations and hubs. And I think that there's other places where the scalability, and when I was listening to you talk on China, you know, there was all the IP theft. Huawei had actually quantum leaped a lot of the other makers in terms of its receptors and technology, and they've got the facial recognition and everything going on, and that's yep. camera work and that's everything. In terms of implementation and a lot of things, they've actually surpassed. So we just don't hear it because it's not well marketed to us by Fortune magazine or Time or Newsweek. But the notion that there's one place in the globe for any new innovation in the technological space, I think is going to fade quickly. And we're going to start hearing about the new heroes. And it wouldn't shock me if it's Chiang Mai and Beijing and Tel Aviv and these places. And then you're going to start having some major equities that are going to make markets and indices, much like how Apple made the NASDAQ or Cisco or one of the others. And then you're going to see others clustering around it as the new hot thing. And I think the money's going to flow. And does that lead to a macro stagnation in the States? Like you've seen, don't forget Japan hit 40,000 on the Nikkei in 89 and has not got anywhere close since, despite a huge amount of inflation now in commodities. They were the buy the damn dip team long before anyone else was. That Japanification of stock market performance after the next demand-destroying event, does America really snap back as far? Or will something have changed that you should be following a all shared tracker in one of these other nations.
Yeah, totally agree. And on all parts. And the, you know, there's a famous song in the 80s by a band called The Vapors, called Turning Japanese. And yes, we are definitely turning Japanese. And, you know, if you look at Japan, what happens in Japan, if you fast forward 11 years, that's what happens in the United States. So whether it was the peak in 1989, we had our peak in 2000, whether it's the downgrade of bonds in 94 and our bonds got downgraded in 2005. So all the things happen 11 years later because we're demographically just 11 years behind them. And yeah, all of those things are inevitable, right? You can't fix demographics. You can't, you know, turn on immigration and fix it. You can't make people stop aging. And demographic patterns repeat, right? We know at age 14, you will consume the maximum number of potato chips in your life. We know that age 46 and a half, you will spend the most in your life,
money,
right? Because you got kids in college and the big house and the cars and the vacations.
Which was the big, which tied up with the Bill Clinton surplus era. The boomers' average age, 46 and a half, and it's the first time that Democrats, no less, actually providing a surplus, one of the few years that you were in deficit spending. So it was fascinating. Sorry, I had to come back.
Definitely no politics, and everything to do with demographics.
Yeah, and everything, and everyone praised Clinton. It was the economy, stupid, and made a hero out of him, and actually contributed very little to that fact, apart from brilliant timing and demographics.
Yep. Yeah. Now look, and that is the way the world works. And to your point, you know, most people have no idea that there are 220 million people in Indonesia. I ask people all the time, how many people in Indonesia? I don't know, 25 million. I'm like, no, that's Australia. He said, it's like, come on. I mean, 220 million people, that's a lot of people. And they are changing. So, you know, I think about exchanges, right? There's a new digital exchange in Indonesia. And as people embrace digital assets, that exchange will do well. Now, maybe they make the same mistakes that FTX and others made. Hopefully not. But, you know, to me, FTX is an example of bad people do bad things. It's not a failure of crypto. It's not a failure of the model. You know, 538 banks have gone out of business since the global financial crisis in the United States. No one talks about the end of the banking system. No one talks about, oh, we should shut down all the banks. One exchange went bad because a bad guy and gal did some bad things. That's not the end of the world. So ultimately, we will migrate from traditional finance through centralized finance, ultimately to decentralized finance. Ultimately, everything will run on blockchains, the same way that all of tech used to run on COBOL and Fortran. Then it migrated to Spark, then it migrated to DOS and Windows, then it migrated to TCP/IP, then it migrated to iOS and Android, and eventually it will run on blockchains. And it's as inevitable as the sun rising tomorrow. It's just going to happen, and you can fight it if you're an incumbent, but ultimately incumbents lose to the disruptors. And to the conversation we had earlier, you can either embrace it or lose. And my feeling is incumbents are always afraid to give up the good to go for the great. They're afraid to disrupt themselves. And that's why they get disrupted. And I think
the tech cycle of disruption is far faster as well now.
Yeah.
So, you know, peak Apple. Who knows? Maybe at some point they're so cash generative, it'll take a long time for it to go wrong. But, you know, eventually, potentially.
Yep.
Yeah. So what carry on.
No, I was just saying, I enjoy the conversation. I look forward to doing it again. I do have to jump.
Yes. No, absolutely.
But I really do appreciate your perspective. You come at the macro landscape from a very unique place of data and analysis, rather than opinion and narrative, which I really, really enjoy. So I really enjoy these conversations and look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, how do people find the website? Give them a shout out if they wish to engage in asset management.
So MorganCreekCap.com is our corporate website. And then, you know, I'm on Twitter at Mark Yusko, MarkYusko. And pretty accessible there. And as my wife says, I'm on it too much, but I enjoy it. What I love is, you know, because of things like Twitter and because of the digital age, you know, again, you and I can have a conversation in real time halfway around the world and get to know each other and become friends. So I appreciate where we are. I do agree that, you know, we are in a difficult period right now from a macro perspective and a volatility perspective. But if we take that long view that you described and that differentiated view of thinking about where's the puck going, to torture the hockey analogy, we'll all be better off. And the, you know, the more people listen to shows like yours that actually encourage dialogue and debate in search of truth rather than just, you know, constantly spewing the current narrative. So love what you do. Appreciate being part of it and look forward to doing it again.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll end. Mark, thank you so much for coming on. And we look forward to that moment when we speak again. Till next time.
Thanks, Francis. Be well.